I think, ready to call our first case, State versus Smith. Counsel, are you ready to proceed? Please do.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Tiffany Winter, and along with Lisa Cumper, we represent the state of Wisconsin. This case presents two issues of the Fourth Amendment that arise in the context of a traffic stop. The first asks whether an officer is permitted to perform ordinary traffic-related inquiries when he lawfully stops a vehicle, but when reasonable suspicion dissipates before the officer makes contact with the driver. The second issue asks whether the officer, in this case, was permitted to open the door of the vehicle to make those inquiries. The state is asking that the court conclude that the answer to both of those questions is yes, and reverse the Court of Appeals that did not directly decide these issues, but instead determined that because the issues were not fully presented, they were going to reverse and remand directions to allow Mr. Smith to withdraw his plea. The first issue presented, again, is whether the officer is permitted to perform ordinary traffic-related inquiries when he lawfully stops a vehicle.
I'm going to interrupt just to ask for clarification with regard to the issues. The petition for review sets forth two issues, as does the brief in chief that you file. Nevertheless, at the very end, tagged on seems to be another issue, inevitable discovery.
Yes.
It is listed as Roman numeral one is the first issue, number two, second issue about opening the door, number three is inevitable discovery in your argument, but it's not listed as an issue when you set forth the statement of issues, and it wasn't listed as an issue in your petition for review. So what should we do with this question mark?
The inevitable discovery issue was briefed by the state because it was essentially what was argued by the state in the Court of Appeals, although okay. That argument was not fully developed.
Is it an issue?
It is. It would be only an issue if this court decides that the officer is permitted to make the ordinary traffic-related inquiries, but he is not allowed to open the door. That is when inevitable discovery would come into play.
Okay, so the answer to my question, is my question capable of a yes or no answer? Maybe it isn't, but I just want to know, is inevitable discovery an issue in this case?
Well, it may be an issue. The real question is it one that you have forfeited? Is that your question?
Well, no, I was perplexed because it's not listed in the petition for review. It's not listed as a statement of issues, and yet in the argument it's set forth as an issue. So I just didn't know where you were coming from.
And the rule says if you don't put it in the petition of review, you don't have a right to argue it.
That is correct.
Counsel, is the... the permissible.
Can she answer my question?
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you had.
That is correct. It is argued in the alternative, and the state is fully aware that it was not a part of the petition for review, and that this court may decline to reach that issue.
Right. It's not as a matter of right. Okay.
Right.
Thank you.
Counsel, is the permissible duration of a traffic stop defined by the mission of the stop?
Yes, that is.
How would you define the mission of this stop?
The state would define the mission consistent with the holding and the Rodriguez decision of the U.S. Supreme Court, which is the scope or the mission of the traffic stop includes all ordinary traffic-related inquiries, because those inquiries are part of the purpose of the stop, which is the lawful and safe operation of vehicles on our roadways.
And do those inquiries have to be related to the purpose of the stop?
No, they do not. They are part of the scope or mission of the stop, apart from the reason for the stop itself. And this is true regardless if reasonable suspicion has dissipated or not. So officers are routinely permitted to ask for things like the driver's proof of insurance or the vehicle registration, even if that is not related to the purpose for which they stopped the vehicle.
Well, can there be a stop for any reason, for no reason?
No, there cannot. Okay. That would be...
So. You can't stop me if there's no reason to stop me and ask me these ordinary questions. Is that right?
That is true. The state's position is that these questions are a part of the scope of a lawful stop, so a stop that was lawful at its inception.
once there's a lawful stop, it can be extended beyond reasonable suspicion, the time of reasonable suspicion.
Well, the ordinary traffic-related inquiries are not an extension. Rather, they're part of the scope or mission of the stop itself. So it's not that the stop is extended to perform these inquiries, but that the inquiries are inherently a part of a lawful traffic stop.
Is this the one way they think that there's a person of a particular agenda driving the car, finds out it's not, so that the mission is gone? Isn't that this case?
In this case, the officer discovered that the driver, or the registered owner, I should say, of the vehicle had a suspended license.
Right.
And after he stopped the vehicle, he discovered that the driver was not the same sex as the registered owner of the vehicle. So reasonable suspicion dissipated quickly after he stopped the vehicle, but the stop was lawful at its inception. And that is the state's position, is that any lawful stop includes the ordinary traffic-related inquiries that are traditionally associated with a traffic stop.
So what was the purpose of these normal traffic-related inquiries once the officer knew that the reason for pulling the person over no longer existed?
The purpose of those inquiries are the same purpose of any traffic stop, which is the lawful and safe enforcement or safe operation of vehicles on our roadways.
Yeah.
So in the context of traffic, the Fourth Amendment has always included some little incremental extensions or intrusions, however you want to word it, because the traffic itself presents a unique context in which we look at the Fourth Amendment. And so because of the fact that we are in the traffic-related context, there are these additional inquiries that are permitted.
But so what is the reason for allowing those additional inquiries?
Because if the purpose of the stop or the scope or the mission of the stop includes those types of inquiries. Once the vehicle is lawfully stopped, the purpose of the stop was to ensure the safe or lawful operation of the vehicle, and those inquiries have that same purpose.
So anytime the person is pulled over, the officer can inquire into not only the existence of the driver's license and the person's identification, could he also inquire into the various safety equipment on the car?
I don't believe that would go that far. So as it was discussed in the Rodriguez opinion, it is the inquiries that we traditionally associate with a traffic stop, which is asking for the driver's license and identification, running a warrant check, and asking for any other required documentation that the state requires for an individual to operate a vehicle on their roadways. So that would include things like asking for the vehicle's registration, potentially proof of insurance. But it would not go into investigating whether the vehicle itself had all of this required safety equipment.
So the reason you give for why the officer can ask these questions is because these are the questions that are traditionally asked in this context. But what I wanted to know is the reason. And the reason I want to know the reason is because if it's simply a matter of inquiring after compliance with requirements for safely operating a vehicle, as you're saying, then why would that not extend to all of the other incidents, making sure the brakes work, making sure the turn signals work? Those are related to the safe conduct of the automobile as well, aren't they?
They are, but they're more investigatory than it is asking for a driver's license or proof of insurance or running the person through a criminal background or through a warrant check.
Okay.
So there's a difference between investigating something other than the purpose of the stop and asking inquiries that are included within the mission or scope of the stop.
So the investigatory purpose of the stop evaporated as soon as the officer realized this was not the registered owner of the vehicle. So why is it not investigatory for him to then be asking for identification, maybe proof of insurance, and all the traditional questions that are associated with a stop? Why isn't it investigatory at that point when the officer knows there's no reason for having pulled this person over in the first place?
Well, to answer that question, I think it's helpful to understand that there is, in a lot of traffic stops, there is nothing to investigate. So even if the officer had observed this vehicle speeding and he pulled the individual over for a speeding violation, there is nothing for the officer to investigate. He knows that the person was speeding, reasonable suspicion or probable cause has been confirmed. There's no investigatory function. It is because traffic is different, where that there's not necessarily an ongoing need for investigation, that we have, that they have set aside these ordinary traffic-related inquiries and allowed officers to conduct them without an additional suspicion or probable cause, because in most circumstances, suspicion would have been confirmed or dispelled by the time the officer made contact. So the rationale, I think what you're getting to behind these inquiries can be or has been explained in both the State versus Ellenbecker and the State versus Williams decision. And there's a multitude of different policy considerations for allowing these inquiries, one of which is we would like officers to document their contact with individuals that they have on the roadway. This ensures that both the individual has some sort of recourse if something happened during the stop that was unlawful, that it is documented, and also that the officer has some sort of recourse if he has some claim that is brought against him in the future for unlawful conduct. There is also a statute in Wisconsin, which is Wisconsin Statute Section 343.18 sub 1, that requires any driver to produce, display their license on demand when they are the subject of a traffic stop. And so the only way to enforce that statute would be to allow the officers to ask for identification when they stop a vehicle.
Counselor, you know, I just want to interrupt you with something. When I was reading these briefs, it occurred to me, I know the state conceded that the purpose for the stop evaporated when the officer was walking up to the car and it appeared that a man was driving the car.
Yes.
Because a woman was the owner of the car. In this day and age, though, people don't always present themselves to the world consistent with their biological sex. And I was surprised the state just conceded it, because until he had the driver's license, how did he know the person that was in the seat was actually a man and not a woman? Well, nobody argued that, but as I read the briefs, I thought, well.
Yeah, the state did consider that as well. Mm-hmm. The testimony here at the suppression hearing, though, from the officer was that he was certain that the driver was a male. And so the state, from a factual standpoint, didn't want to get into a situation where essentially we are allowing officers to investigate or even potentially pull a vehicle over under newer because they can't know for certain of the sex of the driver. And they think that the application of certainty, whether the individual was male or female, could lead to an expansion of the scope of traffic stops that we don't have today.
You misunderstand my concern.
Okay.
I don't think that the officer need to investigate whether the driver was a male or a female. What the officer need to investigate was whether the driver was the owner of the car, because the owner of the car's license was expired. So it doesn't matter who's driving the car or really how they're dressed. I was just kind of surprised that you didn't argue that until you had the driver's license, you didn't know that the owner was not driving the car. You're just going by appearance, and people do not always present themselves consistent with their biological makeup in this day and age.
Right. Yes, that is true. Again, the state just thought that that was maybe too expansive of an argument that
that's
you
fine.
Continue yes. to investigate into whether the driver was the owner of the vehicle based on an uncertainty if the driver was male or female.
Counsel, you make an argument about the difference between inquiry, which is permissible, and investigation, which is not permissible.
Correct.
And that seems like a slippery slope. Justice, you were asked earlier by Justice Kelly, the purpose of the stop. Well, how do you justify that rather nebulous distinction given the purpose of the Fourth Amendment?
The reasonableness requirement?
Part of the purpose of the Fourth Amendment is to not allow unfettered governmental intrusions, right?
Correct.
So we need something fettered. And it sounds to me like your fettering here is a slippery slope. What is an inquiry to you might be an investigatory question to another, leaving very little certainty to the issue at hand.
The Fourth Amendment is always a fact-intensive inquiry, so there is, I guess, a potential that somebody could claim that something is an inquiry when it is really more of an investigation. However, these ordinary traffic-related inquiries are fairly well defined by the United States Supreme Court and by the Court of Appeals here.
Your opposing counsel will say, as you point to Rodriguez, that Rodriguez was the language taken from Justice Ginsburg's opinion, is in the context of an ongoing lawful seizure, and that you don't have an ongoing lawful seizure once reasonable suspicion has been dissipated. How do you respond to that?
Well, the seizure here was ongoing and lawful because an ongoing lawful seizure is defined by the scope or mission of the traffic stop. That is what was decided in Rodriguez, and they decided a part of that scope or mission is the ordinary traffic-related inquiries.
That seems awfully circuitous to me. I don't know how to break this circle. You said earlier that the purpose of the stop is to include safe and lawful operation of the car, and yet that seems to beg the question, does that premise retain vitality in the context of a situation where the reasonable suspicion has been dissipated?
And the state's position is that it does, because if the officer was required in this context or in another context where reasonable suspicion dissipates before he even makes contact with the driver, then the officer is essentially required to wave the driver off and to let him be on his way. If we are saying that any contact after the dissipation of reasonable suspicion is an extension of the traffic stop, then the officer can't make contact at all.
I think that's not what your opposing counsel is arguing. I think both the Coleman case out of the state of Iowa and the McSwain case, which I think was a Tenth Circuit case, speak of once it has dissipated reasonable suspicion, then it is within constitutional boundaries to be able to go to the driver and explain, you know, the situation and let the driver move on. Now, those cases and others stand for that premise, so it isn't that you just wave them on.
Right. Well, prior to Rodriguez, there were decisions in the federal circuits that said that you can't make any contact whatsoever. So it is where we draw the line here. You mentioned the Coleman case out of Iowa, and what is significant about that case is the Iowa Supreme Court decided that case on the grounds of the Iowa Constitution, which they have a long-standing history of interpreting as providing more protections to the citizens of Iowa than the United States Constitution. The only state that has addressed this specific issue post-Rodriguez is Illinois in the Cummings decision. That case was actually had a petition for certiorari that was remanded after Rodriguez was decided with directions that the court readdress the issues presented in light of the Rodriguez decision. And there, the Illinois Supreme Court concluded that in light of Rodriguez, there was no extension of the traffic stop when the officer asked the ordinary traffic-related inquiry.
And that, Ms. Winter, was because Illinois determined following Rodriguez that the normal and incidental questions of the stop were a natural extension that the officer was permitted to ask in any event. Am I right?
I would take issue with the word extension, but yes, that they are part of the scope or mission of the traffic stop, and
part
they did
of the
extend
mission.
The stop.
I stand corrected. Now, one of the issues that came to my mind when I was reading this case is more of an overarching concern. And that is that the purpose of the Fourth Amendment, as I recall it, was a reaction on the part of the founders to enshrine and guarantee what they viewed as the God-given right to each of the individuals of this country for unfettered travel. And that was in reaction to the then occupying force of the British military to be able to stop and search anyone traveling for no cause and to impede their travel. In fact, we see that in many countries across the globe, even today, of course, where their citizens do not enjoy the right to travel from state to state or even within the state without permits or permission from the government. Here in our country, because the founders determined that it was the correct thing to do to enshrine and guarantee the right, not grant it. So often people conflate the Constitution as granting rights. The founders never envisioned that. The founders said, we are going to guarantee the rights that already exist by the fact of the Creator granting the rights to the individual. We are going to enshrine those rights, and we're going to leave it up to the prosecutors and the defense lawyers and the judges to breathe life into those rights. So my concern here, my concern when I read this case was, if we seven permit this line of reasoning from Rodriguez to stand in our state, and I'm not too crazy about the Iowa way either, because once you start in delving into parallel language between state constitution and federal constitution, parallel provisions with parallel languages, and you begin to interpret them differently, then I think a court leaves itself wide open to very legitimate criticism that they're simply imposing their personal will and their personal ideas on what should be a uniform, objective right. So I'm not wild about the Iowa Coleman decision. But I try to balance that against how do we give life to the founder's vision of unimpeded travel once, unless as Chief Justice Rogensack says, which the state conceded, we see that with our military now. General Mattis has put a 6-month hold on the president's direction to throw all the transgendered military out. It's become a national issue. Who's who as far as the gender goes? How do we continue to guarantee to our citizens the freedom of unimpeded travel within the borders of our country as our founders saw the right? Well, as the state has conceded here, the reasonable suspicion for the stop dissipated 10 to 15 feet or 10 feet or so once the officer saw it wasn't the owner of the car. That's my 30,000 feet concern on this case.
Sure. The hallmark of the Fourth Amendment has always been reasonableness, and what the state asks this court is to not lose sight of the fact that this traffic stop was lawful at its inception.
Yeah.
And it is because we look at whether that officer's actions were reasonable. We were not necessarily concerned with an arbitrary stop because we have a lawful stop already that satisfies the Fourth Amendment. And so it was reasonable when the stop is lawful at its inception for the officer to perform those ordinary traffic-related inquiries. The state fully concedes that an officer is not permitted to simply stop someone to perform these inquiries. It is only within the context of a lawful traffic stop that these inquiries come into play because they are part of that scope or mission.
I was a little surprised, and I might have to ask you to repeat yourself. I have 2 full ear infections,
okay.
So I'm doing the best I can. And so far, I appreciate your articulation. You're doing much better than 90% of them. I'm sorry, I just lost my train of thought. What's the last thing you said?
That the argument the state is putting forward here is that the ordinary inquiries are permissible as the part of the scope of just to perform these inquiries. These inquiries are a part of the scope or the mission of a lawful traffic stop, and we have a lawful traffic stop here.
Even if the original grounds is dissipated.
Correct.
Counsel, I want to walk you through, if I might,
The red light is on, Justice Kelly, so unless it's a pressing question.
I'll get back to you after your cohort, too.
Right, thank you.
Thank you.
Let me just remind you, there's a second issue about opening the door, and I'd like you to address that on reply.
Good morning, Justices, and thank you. My name is Chris Sovic, and I represent Frederick Smith in this case.
Would you be kind enough to lift that microphone a little towards you? Thank you.
Put simply, the issue in this case is what a police officer can do once reasonable suspicion justifying a traffic stop has dissipated. I ask this court to find that an officer cannot extend a traffic stop once reasonable suspicion has dissipated. And this finding and holding is supported by a long line of cases from the United States Supreme Court.
The reason you have to put this in terms of extending the traffic stop is that because these cases that you're going to tell us talk about extension.
Correct.
Okay. But the real issue is, can you ask these questions after reasonable suspicion dissipates? But you're putting it in these terms because of the case law.
I will.
In my opinion.
Okay. So,
isn't that your purpose?
My argument is no. These questions are not something that can be asked in a case like this where reasonable suspicion is dissipated.
Because it extends the stop.
Correct, because it extends the stop.
Okay.
And I guess my first basis of argument, just going back to some precedent, you have to go back all the way to a case like Prowse, which says that it's a case where there are random traffic stops, basically, of drivers. And the Prowse case says you cannot do this without reasonable suspicion.
But everybody agrees this wasn't a random stop. I mean, this was lawful at its inception, and I now remember what I was going to ask your opposing counsel, but it's equally applicable to you.
Sure.
The idea is one of the fundamental concepts, and I was a little surprised not to see anybody address it in their briefs, is that a law enforcement officer does have a right. Now, granted, it has been recognized by the United States Supreme Court in different contexts. The one that stands to mind is the famous Terry case. I don't know that that was the first time it was recognized, but that's the first time I remember it being recognized, and that's going back a long ways. To know the identity of the person that they have lawfully encountered. And here, the officer has lawfully encountered the person in that it wasn't just a random, boy, I feel like pulling this person over kind of thing. In other words, I want to baselessly impede their constitutional right to travel. I'm going to pull this person over under reasonable suspicion for driving without a license. Okay. It turns out I might be wrong. The officer says I might be wrong based upon their appearance. But still, that doesn't seem to change the fact that the encounter itself is lawful. Doesn't the officer have a right to know the identity of the person that they have encountered?
I would argue that they don't. I agree with you that, for example, in citing to the Prowse case, that case...
That what?
Compared to our case. At its inception is different. At its inception, this case, there is a lawful sort of traffic violation, we're at the same place as Prowse. At that point, anything else that the officer does is impeding the person from leaving, and they should be free to go because they're being held without
any standard. Are we supposed to view this subjectively through, are we bound by the officer's subjective perception? I mean, I go back and look, this is on all our minds. It just happens to be that the Chief Justice articulated it. And it's in the news, it's in the media a lot with the seemingly conflict between the president and his, the chairman of his Joint Chiefs of Staff with the transgendered issue serving in the military. Maybe a little confusing these days to tell who's who. And are we bound by the subjective? I know in the community caretaker context, our court is expressly not bound. We are to determine what a reasonable officer under the same or similar conditions, that what the officer testifies to is interesting but not determinative. So are we bound by the observations of the officer from 10 feet away that this person is a biological male and not a biological female? It's odd. I never would have thought 10 years ago I'd be asking this question, believe me. But here we are. Times change.
I would say we're bound to the facts from that suppression. And the objective
unless
facts.
Clearly erroneous. Right. I guess it was there a specific, and that's the facts from the trial court, unless clearly erroneous. Did the trial court make the determination?
The determination of the facts in this case.
I think overall, yes. I think the trial court did adopt the officer's testimony that the driver was male.
Correct. Yeah. Those are the only objective facts from this hearing.
Yeah.
And therefore, those are the facts of this case. Is at that point, the officer knew that this driver was male and therefore was not violating the law by driving on a suspended license to the officer's knowledge at that point. And in looking at the suppression hearing, that's the only objective conclusion that the court could come to.
Counselor, how can the officer enforce 343.18 of the Wisconsin statutes if he doesn't ask the driver to see his license?
Well, I would say that what's important is that statute also, it's limited by other statutes that make it clear that an officer cannot stop a person or a person traveling in a car without a reasonable suspicion to do that.
Well, we already have reasonable suspicion. You've conceded that. And my question to you is, once you've stopped the car, how can the officer enforce 343.18 if he doesn't ask to see the driver's license, regardless of what he thinks about whether this is the owner of the car or not?
Sure, but as case law says, as well as I believe it's 968.24, to have a brief detention of a person or a driver of a car, you have to have reasonable suspicion, and this is gone, and because it's gone, he isn't entitled to enforce the statute.
Well, if you lose on your argument that it's gone, then you're out of luck for addressing my question, right?
Correct. If the court determines that the officer was permitted in this case to ask for the driver's license and run a check on the driver's license, then certainly he would be enforcing that statute.
Right. I think that's opposing counsel's argument, is that the scope of the stop, once there's reasonable suspicion, includes ancillary questions, and one of the ancillary questions is, let me see your driver's license.
And I would argue it doesn't. And so I guess I can point to Rodriguez supports my assessment that it does not allow for these ordinary inquiries in a factual setting where reasonable suspicion supporting the stop has dissipated. And I think the first thing that's important is you have to look at the actual language of the holding of Rodriguez, which says a seizure is justified only by a police observed traffic violation, and it therefore becomes unlawful if it is prolonged beyond the time reasonably required to complete the mission of issuing a ticket for the violation. What that holding says is the mission stops when issuing the ticket stops. In this case, the officer, when he was about 5 to 10 feet away, realized that there was no ticket that he could issue, so the mission was over. So he couldn't then go and take part in these, quote, ordinary inquiries that are discussed in Rodriguez.
Isn't the difference between you and the state what is the mission, defining the mission? You define the mission narrowly as to what was the illegality that's being investigated. Oh, you may not like the word investigated, but what the inquiry is. And the state's position is, once there's a lawful stop, the mission includes these ordinary, what they consider ordinary questions.
Correct. My argument is they don't.
That's right. So it's a matter of defining the mission, right?
Correct.
And where do you get a definition of mission that supports you, and where do you get a mission that doesn't support you?
Well, the holding that I just read from Rodriguez supports my assessment that the mission is to issue a ticket for the suspected violation.
But Rodriguez doesn't really define mission. You're defining it, Rodriguez, aren't you?
From that holding, I think they do define it that way, that that is the mission. I mean, that's what the holding says in Rodriguez. I understand that Rodriguez further goes into a discussion about ordinary inquiries, but I think it's important to look at Rodriguez in the context in which Rodriguez discusses that. The facts of Rodriguez are that this is, in Rodriguez, it's an ongoing lawful traffic stop supported by continued reasonable suspicion of a traffic violation.
I guess I'm hearkening back maybe a little bit to trial court days, but I remember coming up both ways, really, depending on the circumstances, on cases where after the violation is over, the ticket is issued, right before the officer walks away, the officer says, hey, you know what? Can I search your car?
Sure.
And then the person says, often, yes, and that's why it ends up in court, and there's the dispute over whether they knew that, you know, they could say no, long and the short of it. So what, if we go your way on this case, what happens to that question? That can't be asked, right?
Well, I guess I'm not sure that this case completely affects that.
Why not?
Well,
if it has to end, and
right,
it just ends, and you give the ticket, roll up the window, have to go. How can an officer ever ask that question? Maybe they shouldn't be able to.
Sure.
But I'm trying to be a little bit practical here, too. How does that work?
The difference is in this case, the officer never indicated to the driver of this car, Mr. Smith, at any point that he was free to go, so that he would understand that he was able to say no to those types of questions. So I guess we're sort of talking about a badger stop situation, and I'm not sure finding that he wasn't allowed to do what he did here is going to affect that at all. He would have had to, though, say, you are free to leave.
Counsel,
which didn't happen.
I would like to move, if you're finished. Annette, are you finished with your question?
Yes, Anne. Thank you.
I would like to move to the second issue. And the second issue, of course, deals with the officer opening the door of the passenger side of the vehicle.
Right.
And the question is whether or not that is an unlawful search. Would you tell me your argument? I understand that that question is going to be asked of opposing counsel on rebuttal, so I want you to be able to address it, given that you will have no rebuttal.
Thank you. I would, if we get past the first issue and assume that the officer is allowed to do some version of requesting for a driver's license or something along those lines.
That's correct. That is, if you win on the first issue, there's no need to get to the second issue. But if you don't prevail on the first issue, then you get to the second issue.
Right. Okay. And if we do get to that second issue, what the officer did in this case was a search. He walked around to the passenger side of his car, and he opened the door. And by opening the door, he exposed the interior of that vehicle case law says a search violates the Fourth Amendment only when police violate a subjective expectation of privacy that society is prepared to recognize as reasonable, basically. And I think looking at sort of those two prongs, they favor Mr. Smith in this case, the officer not being allowed to open the passenger side door. Mr. Smith did demonstrate a subjective expectation of privacy in his vehicle. He was driving in a car, the doors were closed, the windows were up. He has a subjective expectation, that's what's in that car.
But you're leaving out some of the salient points. By the time the officer had opened the passenger door, the driver had informed the officer that the driver's side door and the driver's side window were inoperable. How does that fit in?
The officer asked the question and he answered them that they were inoperable. I don't believe there's any indication, though, that he was.
Well, the questions included, would you step out of the car?
Say that again.
The officer had asked the driver to step out of the car.
I don't believe he had at that point. Those aren't the facts. Okay. They were communicating at the
How
window.
Did it come up? I don't remember then how it came up that the driver told him that the window and the door didn't work.
The officer approached, and I believe the officer requested him to roll down his window, at which point Mr. Smith then communicates with the officer, I can't do that. Window's broken. Door's broken.
Okay.
And then the officer, after that, walked around to the passenger side of the car.
Right.
And then opened his passenger side.
So say I agree with you that in the ordinary case where either it hasn't been discussed that the driver's side door and window and or window are inoperable or they are demonstrably operable, that it would not be within the parameters of the Fourth Amendment rules of search and seizure for, you know, to have officer's choice about which door to open. Okay, say I'm with you there.
Sure.
But say, and this is assuming, as Justice Ann Walsh Bradley said, you lose on the first issue, that that we get to the second issue, and then under these facts, under the facts where the officer now knows that the driver's side door, and then we add to that the fact that it is undisputed that at the time the officer opened the door, the driver was reaching for not just the passenger door, but the testimony said the lever that operates the door handle that operates the means of egress. He said he was reaching for it for leverage to get out, which to me sounds odd. Usually those handles are pretty insubstantial. It seems to me you'd grab something else if you were looking for leverage, but that's the testimony. So under these facts, Do we have to look at other things? Does that make your analysis a little more, does that cause your analysis to be a little more precise as opposed to a blanket rule?
I mean, with any Fourth Amendment case, of course, you have to look at the particular facts of the case, but what I would say is there are no objective facts from the suppression hearing here that Mr. Smith was sliding over in the car to open it himself and acquiesce to the door being opened. And so I do think he has displayed a subjective expectation of privacy. And I think case law also has shown that an individual does have an expectation of privacy in their car and that some society is willing to recognize.
And just speaking for me, the privacy is the closest thing because you've got things we probably, most of us in this room, from time to time, will keep things on our passenger seat that we have a reason, that we really feel a subjective reasonable expectation of privacy and one that society is prepared to view as reasonable, that we don't want to hold out to the public. and that by opening the passenger side door, the officer is going to have a view to that. But how, under these facts, like you just said when you began to respond to my question, you began your response with, well, of course, we have to view each and every Fourth Amendment search and seizure under the specific facts of this case. Well, the officer knew. How else will the officer, this is assuming again, and I know you don't want to assume it, but assume you lose on the first issue, we're stuck now here in second issue land. So I'm asking you, under the parameters that we're having this discussion, what else is the officer supposed to do?
Well, I mean, I guess he does have other options. One is to not actually open the door himself and request that Mr. Smith crack the passenger side window. And if ultimately the objective here is only to get his driver's license and run a check on that, Mr. Smith could have sent it through the crack of the window. And that doesn't involve the officer taking the step of intrusively opening the door of the car, which opens the car up to everything that's inside it, opens it to the public, and violates that right to privacy he has in the vehicle.
I don't remember off the top of my head what the officer's testimony was for why he opened the door. What was it?
The officer basically, all he testified to is that he wanted to communicate better with Mr. Smith. Beyond that, there's no testimony in the record as to, I guess, what exactly he wanted to communicate.
Counselor, doesn't the officer have the right, pursuant to Pennsylvania versus Mims, to order the driver out of the car in any traffic stop?
Not in any traffic stop, and not in this traffic stop. So Pennsylvania v. Mims is a case where there's a suspected traffic violation, an officer pulls over a car and orders the driver out. However, at no point during that stop does reasonable suspicion end that the driver had committed some sort of traffic violation.
Right, so let's again, keeping with the assumptions of Justice Gableman's questions, let's assume you lose on the first issue.
Right.
And we say continues to be a lawful seizure. Pennsylvania versus Mims says the officer, as a matter of course, can order the driver out of the car, right?
Right.
Okay. So in this case, the officer could have simply decided, I'm going to order him out of the car. And he's going to come out of the car by opening the passenger door, right?
I agree with you that ultimately if he's allowed to do that, then one way or another the door is getting open. I disagree that he was allowed to do that in this type of case.
But you're disagreeing because you want to win on the first issue.
I'm disagreeing because I think I should win on the second issue, because in Mims, what justified that intrusion on the person's liberty, that extra intrusion of getting them out of the car, is the fact that there was reasonable suspicion that this individual had violated a traffic offense.
Right, but you're just importing your first issue into your second.
Right, and I'm getting to how that relates here.
All right, so but let's say continues to be a lawful seizure, and that the officer can do all of the normal incidents of a traffic stop. One of those incidents is ordering the individual out of the car. So if that's true, does it matter whether the officer opens the door or the driver opens the door?
I guess what I'm saying is I don't think he can do them the same way as Mims, because he doesn't have reasonable suspicion. And so there would need to be something greater to justify him ordering the individual out of the car in these circumstances, a more particularized objective belief that there's some sort of safety issue, which there wasn't here. But that's just
disagreeing with your opposing counsel's position that asking the incidental questions are a part of every stop, right? That's why you think that you went on number two, because you went on number one.
Well, I mean, they are related, and I guess maybe I'm not describing to you why I see a difference between Mims and this case.
Right, so let's try it this way. Let's say that we agree with the state that asking these incidental questions are part of every traffic stop, and that the officer can continue the stop for the purpose of asking those questions. Let's assume that.
Sure.
Right? So, so is there something about that that, that once we get to asking these incidental questions, that makes MIMS inoperable?
Right. And why I, what I'm trying to say is why I think it makes MIMS inoperable in this case is because the officer, because there is a reasonable suspicion, isn't entitled to that greater intrusion of asking a person to get out of the car. Even if they're allowed to ask at this point for the license, registration, whatever it might be, they still can't do it with that extra intrusion on the person's liberty because they don't have any sort of reasonable suspicion justifying.
Is it, did MIMS say that, or did MIMS just say that as part of a lawful traffic stop, the officer can order the driver out of the car?
I'm making that conclusion in part based on the facts of MIMS, which included a traffic stop.
But there's nothing in MIMS that specifically said he can order him out because of the reasonable suspicion, as opposed to he can order him out because it's a lawful stop.
There's no specific quote that says that, but I guess maybe the analogy I would make is if an officer is going to go and frisk somebody, you need some extra layer of reasonable suspicion to do that, that they're armed and dangerous, to take that next intrusive step.
Right, but there are cases that actually say that, right?
Right. And so I guess the analogy I'm making is here, in this case, you don't have any reasonable suspicion that any law violation was created or done by the driver of this car, and therefore you don't get to the extra incremental intrusion of ordering them out of the car.
Okay. But if the officer does have the right to ask these questions and to see the driver's license, he can do everything necessary to accomplish that purpose, correct?
If he has the right, then I guess it depends on specifically what the court would determine if I lose issue one that he's able to do, certainly. But I would still say that he has to, in this type of circumstance also, and there's case law on this, that he has to use the least intrusive investigative means possible. And I don't think in this type of situation, when reasonable suspicion is dissipated, it's always going to be ordering somebody out of the car.
Could we read into the actions of your client that he perhaps consented to the officer opening the door? Because the officer's testimony was that, quote, he reached over, did the latch mechanism, but since he was leaning over, he could not physically push the door open, and that's when the officer testified that he, well, he testified he pushed it. I think he meant he pulled it open. But isn't there some consent that could be read into that action?
I mean, I don't think you can read in his consent from the facts from the suppression hearing. You know, the facts indicate that, yes, he was sliding over to that side, but I think that was a response to the officer walking over there. The facts don't say that Mr. Smith actually opened the door. I mean, that would be him consenting, as if he opened the door. He didn't say to the officer, hey, go ahead, open the door. He didn't make a hand gesture saying, you can open the door. I mean, the court found that this officer opened the door. So I don't think you can infer his consent.
Even if he did the latch mechanism, which I read to mean he undid the latch mechanism to unlock the door?
And Mr. Smith's testimony was that he grabbed onto more of a side handle that's on the door of older cars. So, no, I don't think from the testimony that was at the hearing we can make any sort of reasonable inference that he was cooperating in this door being opened.
Counsel, if this were without a warrant and at someone an apartment door, I think the state in prior cases has acknowledged that you need unequivocal and specific consent to enter the apartment door.
Sure.
Does MIMS change the consent issue to open the door for a vehicle? Do you understand what I'm saying? Following Justice Kelly's question, Justice Kelly says, hey, MIMS says you can order them out of the car. And so does that holding in MIMS change what, for purposes of an apartment or a house without a warrant, you need unequivocal and specific consent? How does that jurisprudence, which is time and again acknowledged by the state, why doesn't that apply here? Is it because of MIMS?
Or does it apply?
That same requirement for consent, consent being unequivocal and specific.
I guess what I would say, you know, my argument is that the officer is not able to open the door himself at all. I mean, I guess what MIMS gives officers the ability to do is to first order the person out of the car, and then the person is then, I guess, expected to comply with that. I'm not sure. So my argument is no, he couldn't open the door, and so I'm not sure consent really matters.
Well, if he had asked him, or if an argument could be advanced that there was acquiescence, although I don't know, normally it can't be because it's the requirement of unequivocal and specific, but perhaps in cars it can be.
And my argument would be that he couldn't open the door in this case.
Thank you, Counselor.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Rebuttal? I'd like you to begin with the second issue, as Justice Abrahamson asked that you address it, and you didn't have a chance in your opening remarks. Thank you.
State's position on the second issue is that the officer was permitted to open the door of the vehicle in this case, pursuant to Pennsylvania versus MIMS, and based on the facts that were presented to the officer, that he observed the Mr. Smith attempting to comply with his request to open the door or the window.
Except that's not the finding of the court, so you've got to be careful. I noticed in your brief you put forth the, in the statement of facts, you put forth the countervailing testimony, but the court specifically found as an historical fact that it was the officer who opened the door.
Right, so the state is not challenging that evidentiary ruling at all, but the factual finding, that the officer was the individual who opened the door does not mean that the officer didn't observe what he reasonably believed to be Mr. Smith attempting to comply with his request to make contact with him.
Oh, so are you arguing acquiescence of consent?
No. So the state's argument is that pursuant to Pennsylvania versus MIMS, there is a bright line rule that officers can, as a matter of course, order an individual out of the vehicle of a lawful traffic stop. That bright line rule is in no way tied to reasonable suspicion or probable cause for the stop. Instead, it is tied to the inherent danger presented in the context of a traffic stop.
You're extending MIMS then. Bright line rule, your opposing counsel would say, you know, MIMS is distinguished because of ongoing lawful reasonable suspicion. But your bright line, regardless of that, your bright line rule in MIMS is a court officer can order a defendant out of the car, and now you're extending that to say an officer can open the car door in the context of a MIMS order.
The state is not asking for an extension of MIMS as a bright line rule. So if I imply
just that, in this case.
In this case, the state is asking that this court decide that the facts of this case and the rationale underlying MIMS made it reasonable for the officer to open the door to facilitate face-to-face contact with Mr. Smith. The state is not arguing that an officer can, as a matter of course, in any traffic stop, walk up and open the door of the vehicle to facilitate face-to-face
contact. What facts particularly are you relying on for this rule?
Sure. The officer approached Mr. Smith at the driver's side door. He motioned for Smith to roll down the window or asked Smith to open the door. Smith communicated to the officer that he could do neither. The officer then walked around to the passenger side of the vehicle, which is logically the only way for Smith to either exit the vehicle or to roll down a window. When he reached the passenger side of the vehicle, he observed Mr. Smith reaching over to the passenger side of the vehicle, the reasonable inference being that Smith was attempting to comply with the officer's request to make contact with him that was unobstructed by the window or the door. When the officer observed Mr. Smith trying to move to the passenger side of the vehicle, that is when the officer opened the door. So the state's position is that under those specific facts, the officer's actions were reasonable.
What? I'm missing something. The reasonable inferences was that he was complying with the request. Is that what you said?
Yes, complying with the officer's request.
How does that differ from acquiescence of consent? Complying with the request to open the door.
The state's position is that the officer did not need specific requests to open the door in this case.
But
the officer never needs specific consent to open the door in the traffic case. That's what MIMS has decided.
Where in MIMS does it say that the officer can open the door?
The officer can order the individual out of the vehicle as a matter of course.
Right.
The individual is expected to comply with that order.
But if the officer here had asked the driver to either roll the window down or step out of the vehicle, should the officer have waited to see whether the driver was going to roll the window down or step out of the vehicle before the officer unilaterally decided to open the door? And again, this runs back to what I said earlier, which I don't think there's anybody in this room. If they are, they're probably the exception to the rule, that from time to time has not carried documents or whatever in the passenger seat of their motor vehicle, that they have a subjective expectation of privacy that society is prepared to view as reasonable. And so I wonder if, given your recitation of the facts, that the officer had given the driver the choice, would it then be incumbent upon the officer to see which of the two options the driver was going to exercise?
The state's position to that is no.
You think what?
I said the state's position to that is no.
Why?
The officer did not have to wait. Because as it was decided in MIMS, the officer, when an individual is ordered out of a vehicle,
the officer here didn't order him out of the vehicle, according to what you just said. He gave him the choice, roll the window down or step out of the vehicle.
Right.
And if the driver is moving over to the operable door, that could mean, to me, that means either he's going to roll the window down or he's going to get out of the vehicle.
So the state's position is that the underlying rationale of MIMS, which is that the incremental intrusion was de minimis and therefore did not rise to the context of a separate Fourth Amendment event in light of the grave public safety concern of officer safety. So the underlying rationale of MIMS is that there is no separate Fourth Amendment event when the officer orders the individual to step out of the vehicle. Because there is no separate Fourth Amendment event because of this incremental de minimis intrusion, there is no requirement for a separate level of reasonable suspicion in
order to
meet
that. I'd be more inclined to buy your argument if the officer hadn't given the option. Why give the option if you're not going to wait to see which one the guy exercised? Why not just say, I need you to step out of the car?
Well, as Justice Rebecca Bradley pointed out, the officer believed that Mr. Smith had unlatched the door when he opened the door.
But that's not the finding of the trial court.
It is not. The trial court did not make a specific finding on that fact. They found that the officer pulled the door open, but he didn't make a specific finding as to whether Mr. Smith unlatched the door, because the trial court determined that that factual finding was unnecessary for the court's decision. Whether Mr. Smith unlatched the door or not, the trial court concluded that the officer's actions here were reasonable in opening that door, because the officer, pursuant to MIMS, has the ability to request face-to-face contact. And the only way to make face-to-face contact is to go over to the passenger side of the vehicle. And in this case, the most reasonable way to do that was to open the door.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Thank you both very much. That concludes our argument on our first case. We will take a few minutes recess so that other lawyers can come in and begin on the second case. We are adjourned.